Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco, a reporter here at KUNM. We've seen a real shift in the way sexual assault and harassment are being talked about nationally. High power executives, politicians, and celebrities have been fired, suspended, or left their jobs after reports of sexual misconduct and violence. But will this mark a change for everyone? Will more women everywhere be taken seriously when they talk about sexual assault and harassment? We did our first show in this Me Too series last week, and Time magazine just yesterday named the Silence Breakers as the Person of the Year. There's also been some great critical writing about the Me Too movement and race, and how the conversation we're having right now often centers white women, celebrities, and people who work white-collar jobs. So what do you think of Me Too? Does the movement so far leave some folks out? Does the shift in the national conversation make it easier for you to report sexual misconduct or violence? Is there too much at stake for you to talk about harassment or assault at work? Or maybe you're one of millions of people in this country who work a service job in a restaurant without a sexual harassment policy or HR department. We'll get into all of this and more over the course of this hour, and we want to hear from you. Jump into the conversation by calling 277-5866. Corey Lee is the Director of Therapeutic Services at Crossroads for Women, an organization that helps women exit incarceration in New Mexico. Thanks for being here this morning, Corey.
Thank you for having me.
Corey, for some women getting out of jail or prison, what makes it challenging to find a job?
Charges. Their charges can limit their ability to obtain financially viable employment. And so a lot of organizations ask for background checks nowadays. And also the fact that a lot of women who have been incarcerated for long periods of time don't have experience on a resume. So there are a lot of questions in an interview about why they haven't been employed for a long period of time. But I think mostly it's the charges.
And it can be part of the conditions of release or their probation agreement to have a job, right?
Yes. One of the guidelines of standard supervision is to obtain and hold employment. Yes.
And so also custody and visitation with kids sometimes hinges on getting and keeping that job, right?
Yes. And if an individual is working to follow through with a CYFD treatment plan, for instance, one of the guidelines can be to obtain employment.
So that's a lot kind of riding on getting work and finding it, and it's challenging to find and keep. Do you think that might prevent people sometimes from speaking up about problems at work with assault or harassment?
Absolutely. There's a lot of fear and anxiety going exiting incarceration to have to look for that job. For so long, our women are often told no. So there's a lot of fear going into an interview and then being told no, that your previous charges are going to be held against you. And then when you finally obtain employment, you don't want to lose that employment because often not only is it paying the bills, but it's satisfying these requirements.
So a lot of women who end up in incarceration have experienced childhood sexual traumas. And we heard from a caller last week during our first Me Too show about how being assaulted as a child made it really hard for her to speak up as an adult about workplace harassment. Do you see that kind of thing happening with the folks that you work with?
I think trauma impacts everyone differently. And our women not only have experienced trauma in their childhoods, but also trauma in the system itself. And so you have those two different traumas going on, and they impact the way women feel about how powerful their voice is. And so there are a lot of women that feel that they have been asked to remain silent. And so, yes, absolutely.
So what does Crossroads do? What do you do in your work to help women kind of navigate getting that first gig and then feeling empowered in that job to really make sure that they can speak up about this stuff?
We have a great vocational program. Our vocational services manager, Jess Fulton, and her team work with the women to support them in identifying the goals. For some women, that may be obtaining a high school diploma. For other women, that may be going back to school to obtain a different career because they can no longer go into the careers they had before because of their charges. So each person is different, but our vocational team really looks at what someone wants to do and then really tries to find the resources or support the women in finding the resources to help them achieve those goals. We've had women who have obtained their master's degrees. We've had women who get their high school diplomas. We have women who are working on literacy. So a vast array of different services going on at Crossroads.
Yeah, and it's important in this show to recognize that even though we are talking about some pretty bleak situations, that there is a lot of work that people are doing to kind of move this issue forward and to advocate for themselves, right?
Yes.
So maybe you're someone who would like to speak up about harassment you're experiencing at work, but you've got too much on the line to do it. We want to hear from you, and your call can be anonymous. That's not something we usually do here, but we're making an exception today. Call us toll-free at 1-877-899-5866. You can also email letstalknm@kunm.org with your comments or questions. Denicia Cadena is the Policy and Cultural Strategy Director at Young Women United. Good morning, Denicia.
Good morning, Marisa.
So Coralie from Crossroads has been talking about women who are leaving jail or prison, but what about women who are still behind bars?
Well, when we think about women who are incarcerated, there's an inherent power dynamic. Those women and girls and young women in the system are having absolutely every outcome of their lives determined in those settings. So raising questions of harassment, of abuse can be incredibly difficult. And we have seen that in prison settings and with the Border Patrol as well.
And we've seen recently stories of guards who are getting convicted of assault. We also saw a report, I think it was last year or maybe the year before, about a doctor who had been repeatedly accused of assaulting inmates in prison. So this is an institutional problem.
Yeah, absolutely. We saw in New Mexico prisons here an independent health contractor, Horizon, had a health provider that was repeatedly accused of sexually assaulting men in the facility. And instead of firing him and looking into charges, they moved him to another facility. So when we see these sort of endemic problems, we can just assume the magnitude to which young women and girls are facing this in the system.
I think in some ways our culture has also accepted sexual assault as being like part of incarceration, as opposed to viewing it as a violation of the law or as a violation of human rights.
Yeah, absolutely. So we saw under the Obama administration creation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and that was about establishing as a base level, even if you're incarcerated, you deserve your bodily dignity. And I think that's incredibly important, especially for young women and girls. So many, vast majority, over 80% of women in our New Mexico correctional system were themselves survivors of sexual assault and violence, domestic violence in the home. So we really need to work to getting closer to making sure that people have lives free of violence, even when they're incarcerated.
And you're talking about women who are incarcerated and also girls, people who are under 18 and incarcerated within the juvenile justice system.
Yes, absolutely. So unfortunately, those survival rates of violence are true in the juvenile justice system, too. And we can see abuses within the system, too. When a girl is having her whole life regulated by the system, and she may come from a household that she's been abused, even knowing and flagging that's unacceptable behavior can be a problem. And so, you know, it's really important to work with girls outside of the system to prevent this from them getting into the system in the first place, but to let them know that they have outlets when these abuses are occurring.
And part of it, I think, too, that I keep hearing from folks is that if you grow up and you've experienced abuse and then now you're being re-traumatized by the system or you're incarcerated, it can start to feel like your voice is not a thing that's going to be heard if you do speak up, right?
Yeah. And, you know, as a survivor of sexual violence myself, I have to say I have extreme gratitude for Tarana Burke, the founder of the Me Too movement over 10 years ago, that is just now really capturing this groundswell, because I think it makes pretty logical sense for girls and young women to believe that no change would happen, because change hasn't happened. We've seen, people in all sorts of positions of power retain their power, stay in those positions. And so now I think there's a glimpse of hope. But for someone who's experienced a lifetime of abuse and that's all they know, it wouldn't really make sense for them to think anything would change in that situation.
So do you think this kind of national conversation that we're seeing right now, where so many people are coming forward, do you think that it is encouraging young women to be able to feel like maybe they have a shot at sharing their stories and seeing some kind of accountability?
I think it is encouraging. And I think even just about the cultural norms, like even in my mom, my grandma's generation, like abuse within a marriage was not considered abuse. You know, it wasn't appropriate for you to deny a husband sex. So at least for girls to recognize just different cultural values around what consent means, around what self-determination around your own body is really inspiring. And I'm glad that the young women that we work with at Young Women United are leading the forefront as young women of color to what this change should look like in our communities.
And do you think that there can be, with Me Too movement, do you think that we're going to see like long and lasting change beyond just maybe a trend or a hashtag, right?
We have to. I think, you know, women of color, Indigenous women are always at the forefront of truly radical change. And I think that's true for this movement, too. I want to see policies that go beyond demanding sexual harassment training. To me, that's not a real solution. People that are sexually harassing, perpetuating violence already know they're doing something inappropriate. They know that power dynamic exists, and that's why they're perpetuating this violence. So I'd really like to see us create accountable systems in which people who've experienced violence are believed and see some recourse to what's happened in their lives.
And we see so often in the past with these cases, especially, that when people bring them forward, they often experience like a very intense backlash and pretty regularly can't retain their position, like can't continue to work in their job because it is too tenuous and too, you know, tension filled, right? So do you think there needs to be more accountability with the way people are treated after they come forward?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, like I was saying, I don't think it really made logical sense for some of our most marginalized folks and communities to come forward in the past. You know, there wasn't, so few of sexual assault or sexual violence cases are prosecuted. And I don't believe that's the most efficient way to change this in our culture. I think we need more restorative justice. We need more real conversations from when our folks are very young in childhood to talk about what consent means, about what healthy relationships looks like. I think that'll be the true shift, not just, you know, policies around sexual harassment, but true accountability.
And this is going to be the theme throughout the hour, but do you think racism is a factor in how cases are handled when people do come forward?
Oh, absolutely. So even looking at the Time cover, having Taylor Swift on there or Ashley Judd, and absolutely, they had their own incidences around sexual violence. But we know that sexual violence and harassment disproportionately impacts women of color and Indigenous women. Even in the Harvey Weinstein scandal, so many women, dozens of women now have come out accusing him of sexual violence. The only woman he repudiated in the media was Lupita Nyong'o. And I think that's really telling of the violence that's perpetuated against Black, Indigenous, and other women of color.
We're taking your calls this morning. We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 5866. We do have some calls coming in. We're talking about the Me Too movement and women who haven't yet been centered in the conversation. Two-thirds of women who work in restaurants say they've been harassed by managers, according to a survey, and 80% have been harassed by coworkers and customers. And there's lots of other statistics like that out there, too, for people who work in service industry jobs. Are you a server in New Mexico? Have you experienced harassment at work? Were you able to talk to your boss about it? Was there a policy in place to help protect you? Or did you just accept that this kind of thing is part of the job? Give us a call this morning and tell us about it, 277-5866, or tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're going to take a quick break.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM. Since 1976, the firm has litigated Native American law, criminal defense, wrongful death, and civil rights in New Mexico and nationwide. Info at rothsteinlaw.com.
In the mid-1970s, composer Arvo Pärt became obsessed with the peal of bells and even began to imitate bells in his own music. Coming up, music with a Spartan beauty, like Bells from a Faraway Church. Fratres by Arvo Pärt on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
This Saturday on the Children's Hour, kids from Jimmy Carter Middle School's Junior National Honor Society will educate us all about their school's namesake, our 39th president, Nobel Prize-winning humanitarian, Jimmy Carter. From the peanut farm to the White House, there's a lot you don't know yet about President Carter. We'll also kick off Hanukkah with a live performance on the Children's Hour this Saturday, 9 to 10 a.m. right here on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Marisa DeMarco. We're going to take a call now from Albuquerque. Caller, you're on the line.
Hello?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What's your comment or question?
So I wanted to weigh in on this from the perspective of someone who is currently working in a government position where there are sorts of policies and overlays in place that are designed, I think, over the last couple of years to protect people in the workplace and that were well-intentioned. And I never really gave much thought to it until recently we had someone in our office who was repeatedly harassing women by staring at their breasts during the course of the workday. And I had several people complain to me about this conduct, and I told them that they should file a complaint because we have these policies in place. And they expressed concern that if they did so, nothing ever happens. And so they were not comfortable going forward. So then it happened to me, and I filed a complaint, and I said, there are numerous people in this office this is happening to, and they're not comfortable coming forward because they don't think anything's going to happen. So they took my complaint, and they worked it up. Lo and behold, I find out that if action was taken after my complaint was processed, I am not allowed to find out any actions taken in response to the complaint. So to protect the harasser's privacy, they do not let the victim be notified of any steps taken. So obviously, if it's termination, you know he's fired.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's not fired, what did he have to do? Did he have to watch a video? Did he get leave without pay? So it creates this culture of we have so many policies in place. The victim is not really getting that restorative justice in this to know, okay, well, what occurred? So, I mean, I think it's a problem that persists at every level. Because of my position, I felt very comfortable taking him on. I cannot be terminated. I'm not an at-will employee. I have a lot of resources that other women don't have. And even with all of that in place, I still felt like the process itself was far from perfect. So that's my comment.
Well, thanks for sharing your story. I know it can be a challenging thing to do. Let me ask you, do you think the Me Too movement is making it easier to speak about assault or harassment in the workplace? And do you think that it could have an effect on changing policies like the one you're talking about?
So I think from my perspective, I still see a major gap in the workplace depending on positions held. So I will tell you that, and I know that since I'm calling in anonymously and I don't want to disclose too much of the details because that would not be fair, I think that someone of my education and position feels much more comfortable coming forward relative to other people. And I'm hoping that the Me Too movement changes that, and that all women of all backgrounds and socioeconomic statuses and education levels feel comfortable and feel empowered. But what I just saw like play out in 2017 in a government office, I still think there's very much a gap. I'm hoping that the movement changes that. I'm hoping it brings more people to the position where those of us who are willing to speak out, and I wasn't the only one that filed a formal complaint, I don't think. We were all the people that were the attorneys. We were the ones that were willing to speak up. And it's like, well, what about the support staff? You know, why is there that still that gap? And I'm hoping it does have an effect.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Tom from Raton. Tom, good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
What's your question or comment this morning?
Well, one of your guests brought up the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and I work in that field. And one of the things that that we see auditing facilities nationwide, and it's supposed to apply to any facility that has an incarcerated person, which would include halfway houses and jails. But most of the people who are incarcerated are not being protected by the Prison Rape Elimination Act, because these facilities that has women and children, like county jails and county detention centers, are not following the Prison Rape Elimination Act. So I kind of feel like the systemic problem is what society is willing to tolerate, whether it be in the workplace or whether it be in the prison or wherever. If we tolerate our detention facilities not following a federal law and letting women and children be sexually abused and harassed, then in a way that's on us, because we're not looking at our local situations and weighing in and putting pressure on the outside, just like people in the workplace who see other people being abused and harassed aren't speaking up. And I think that's what's going to make the change.
Tom, when you're talking about detention facilities, do you mean immigration detention centers? Or are you talking about jails and juvenile detention centers?
Jails and juvenile detention centers. Immigration facilities are being audited, but a lot of halfway houses and juvenile facilities and county detentions for both adults and juveniles are not following the act. Even though the law requires all of them to, they're choosing not to do that. And so that doesn't leave the protections in place for people. And I wish people would consider that, because, you know, we've kind of all had this thought in our head, well, yeah, that's something that happens in prison, and sometimes we make horrible jokes about that. But we're also talking about women and children. It shouldn't happen to anybody. But, you know, imagine if your child is stupid and goes out, gets picked up on a DUI and goes to a county jail overnight, and something happens because they chose not to follow the Prison Rape Elimination Act. I mean, this is something that we should all be standing up for and making sure that that these facilities are doing what they're required to by law, and it's just the right thing.
Corey from Crossroads, do you have a thought about that?
Yes, absolutely. I agree that in the past that PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, they haven't been diligent. I do think in the last year and a half we have seen a shift. I do think there's more work that needs to be done, but definitely in the last year and a half we've seen a shift with detention centers and prisons following through with PREA. I think there's a lot of requirements set forth in PREA that are unclear and gray. And so I think people are trying to wade through that and trying to figure out, like, is this PREA? Is this not PREA? Mm-hmm. Right now, I think people are being really vigilant and reporting everything as PREA, even if they're not sure. But I definitely believe, you know, that the caller is correct. Tom's right that there needs to be more work. And I know Denicia has a lot of information on what PREA looks like in the juvenile justice system. So.
Yeah, I love Tom bringing that point, because I think Priya was the very first starting point in saying a cultural conversation to say when someone is incarcerated, they deserve to live a life free of violence as well, and in particular sexual violence. But I'm ready for Priya 2.0. It's not a perfect set of policies, and ready to see what the next point looks like, so we can really keep people safe even when they're locked up.
We've got Marian Mendez-Serra here with us today, too. She's a community organizer for workers' justice and civil rights with El Centro de Igualdad y Derechos. Good morning, Marian. Thanks
morning.
For being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Marian, you work with New Mexico workers who are also immigrants. What are some of the fears people might have about reporting sexual harassment in the workplace?
Yeah, I would like to start with recognizing that we're currently living in a very toxic, hostile political environment in which the Trump administration, right, has been targeting and persecuting our communities, which he plans to exponentially expand his exploitation force. He has says that he promised, right, to increase workplace rates as well as enforcement. And we know that the impact can place women who are experiencing sexual harassment, sexual assault, gender discrimination, exploitation in the workplace further into the shadows. So when we're talking about women of color, when we're talking about undocumented immigrant women of color, we're talking about the fears of what if they call federal agents, right? What if they call ICE against me if I were to report? So when we're talking about what are the unique vulnerabilities, right? We should take into consideration the different types of intersectionalities, the barriers and the factors that shape how women decide to come out, how women decide to report, and how do they decide to take action. So it's not only about like what happened, but what are factors and barriers that are leaving women in a place which they are fearful for their life, and they're going on survival mode, right?
Mm-hmm. So I just want to mention that we are taking calls this morning, and if anybody wants to jump in and share their own story, the number is 277-5866. Marian, this can go beyond just not being able to report harassment. Sometimes management might know someone's in a vulnerable position because of their status, and they might try to take advantage of that, right?
Right, and in El Centro, we are an immigrant rights and workers' justice organization. We have a program of workers' justice. It's called Mano a Mano, and it basically means hand in hand. And the intersection, it's in our labor rights program. During the course of our orientations and calls, we are exposed to this kind of stories of abuses from age, gender, national origin discrimination, and we currently have a case of, and we have many cases, but we currently have a case that is extreme in the way that the worker, it's under constant threat of not only fearing termination, but also of being tried with deportation, right? And if she didn't comply to the sexual advances by the employer, it will lead into the fear of, like, what do I do now, right? Mm-hmm. We must recognize that systemic and institutional barriers that women of color go through, and understand that women of color, especially undocumented immigrant women of color, work in industries that perpetuate and that emboldens employers to create models of exploitation in the workplace, and models of in which they think it's okay to do this, right? So when we're talking about how women are able to report and how vulnerable they feel, we must recognize all of these other factors and barriers, as well as linguistic barriers, mm-hmm. right? Cultural differences. I think there's a lot to recognize when we're talking about sexual assault.
Now, Marian, does U.S. law protect everyone from harassment and assault regardless of their status?
So I will say a violation of rights. It's penalized by law regardless of someone's immigration status. There are protections in place under the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and also of Human Rights Act of New Mexico, right? It covers gender discrimination, which includes sexual assault and harassment. So, yes, there are protections in place. We must also recognize that when we have undocumented immigrant woman of color that may not know what the law looks like, mm-hmm. and they're just hearing it's how they're being targeting Latinos, targeting immigrants, targeting Muslims, refugees, and they're just hearing all these things coming down from the pipeline of this administration, and the only thing that they are right now doing is on survival mode, trying to protect themselves, trying to feed their children, trying to live. And when we're trying to see, like, why don't they report, right? We should not be then placing more blame on the survivor, mm-hmm. of why are they not reporting. We should be conscious and recognize all of the other barriers and recognize that we all are in different points in our journey to then make that decision and be bold and take action, right?
Yeah, I want to mention too, to anyone who's listening out there, if you are interested in talking to any of these organizations, we have links on our website to all of your home organizations as well. So if somebody wants to find Marianne and El Centro, if you go to KUNM.org, you can find the information there. So I want to talk to Pamela Herndon. Pamela is here with us this morning. She's the executive director of the Southwest Women's Law Center and a host of Women's Focus here on KUNM. Thanks for being with us here this morning, Pamela.
Oh, thank you so much, Marissa, for having the show today.
So the whole Me Too concept was created by Tarana Burke as a way to create solidarity with women of color who'd been sexually assaulted. And yet so much of what we've seen lately has been focused on white celebrities and high profile folks. Do you think the conversation needs to shift again?
You know what, Marissa? Absolutely, that conversation needs to shift. When Tarana Burke sort of created this idea of Me Too, when she ran into this 13-year-old girl who was assaulted, and the little girl had nowhere to go, and Tarana didn't know how to help her. And so she was looking out and looking for a way to not only give this little girl a voice, but others a voice. And so then for 10 years, that Me Too opportunity just laid silent. It just wasn't there at all. Not until a woman by the name of Alyssa Milano came along and said, you know what, with this tweet, if you've been sexually assaulted or harassed, then respond. And thousands and millions of just came through and responded. But what happened to those women of color? So I would say to you today, Marissa, that the new voice for women of color should be listen to Me Too, because that's the voice that's absent right now.
And how are things different for women of color who bring forward allegations of sexual assault or harassment?
So that's a great question. And to answer that, I just have to take you and this audience back to the 1600s when that first slave ship came into Jamestown. I mean, since then, African-American black women have been demoralized and their bodies have been absolutely fair game. And so now it's sort of like there were these house slaves who were harassed and sexually assaulted by the master at the plantation. Mm-hmm. And it just continued to go on and on and on, and no one listened to these women. So now we're in the 21st century. Those badges and incidences of slavery still exist. So there's a black woman there and she's complaining, you've touched me and you've hurt me and I've been harassed, but you're not listening to me. And so the voices that need to be heard and how to bring them alive are through shows like this. And so thank you for making that happen.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. In one of the critical pieces I read about this issue, it mentions that in some ways it boils down to who our society thinks is worth protecting. Do you think that's part of this?
I think that's absolutely part of this. I mean, there still is not that value that needs to be placed on African-American lives that should be there. I mean, I look at the women that I have spoken to who say, when I call the police, it still takes them an hour to arrive at my home. Or if I call the police, they dismiss me when I arrive. They say, oh, well, it's just you and your man just having a disagreement. But that's not true. They have a story to tell, and it's time for somebody to listen to it.
What do you think it's going to take for this Me Too movement to have a real and lasting impact?
So I think it's gonna take the listen to Me Too movement of the women, the African-American women, to come forth together and to have their voices as one. Just as Alyssa Milano was able to bring thousands and thousands of women together, it's time for African-American women to say, you know, I'm going to point out these names of these people who have been hurting me for years, and it's time for them to be shamed. And so What I'm hoping that will come out of today's show and shows just like this is that we will see this uprising of Black women and African-American women saying, I'm going to point you out because I am no longer going to be demoralized. My body is my own, and it is no longer fair play for you.
Marianne, I think this brings up for me, you talk about, you emphasize that everyone has the right to go after their own justice, right?
Right. Through our program, Mano a Mano, we work hand in hand with workers and explore the different venues of how do we achieve justice. But not only that, but then grow leadership and development for women and workers to feel empowered. It's about then creating the space for them then to come forward, to break the silence, but also how to take action. And when you were talking about how do we transform the Me Too into action, I think, and at least from the undocumented immigrant community, we're already fighting back locally, right? But all across the state, our communities are organizing to pad immigration-friendly and sanctuary policies to protect our families. We must recognize that sanctuary policies create an environment that are conducive for survivors of workplace abuse to come forward, are conducive for policies that will help neutralize the threats that our unscrupulous employers make to call ICE if an employer were to make a report, right, of the abuse. We know that sanctuary policies are, by research, have been said to have less crime, meaning that people are reporting, right? People are reporting the abuses that are happening. And if any woman in the stable were to be a survivor of sexual assault and they were not to break the silence, then anybody of us could be the next target of this abuser. It emboldens employers and emboldens abusers to continue to perpetuate this kind of exploitation, to continue to perpetuate this kind of sexual assault, and to continue to dehumanize women in the workplace.
You know, what's really important that you pointed out is that what about all these domestic workers who are in the home who are
right.
constantly being sexually assaulted
right.
and they're afraid to speak up because they're concerned about even these small jobs that they have. And even when we find policies that are in place, the question is, how do we know that they're going to be enforced?
Right.
We have got to find a way of stronger enforcement. Thank you for bringing that part.
Yeah, how do we move forward, right? And in terms of workplace policies, we know that we had paid sick leave, right? It came down within hundreds of votes of passing. And this would have allowed workers to use the paid sick leave to make a police report, to obtain an order of protection, to seek counseling and safety. So how do we locally, as Albuquerque, how do we locally, as New Mexico, are empowering our women of color, are empowering undocumented immigrant women of color to then come forward? It's about creating spaces, it's about creating platforms, but it's about creating change.
All right, we're talking about the Me Too movement and people in New Mexico who haven't yet been centered in the conversation, and we're taking your calls at 277-5866. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco. We're going to take a quick break.
There's still plenty of time to donate your unwanted car or truck to KUNM and get a tax deduction for 2017. No matter when it sells, your deduction is taken in the year you donate it. Often, Even if it has body damage or major mechanical problems and has to be sold as salvage, it will still qualify you for a substantial tax deduction. To see if your vehicle qualifies, call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
December 7th marks a day of remembrance for the bombing at Pearl Harbor in 1941 and the servicemen and women of World War II. We remember the many Native American and Alaska Natives that significantly aided the war effort. Join us for our conversation about Native peoples in World War II on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Marisa DeMarco, and today we're talking about the Me Too movement and whether it can go beyond celebrities and other high-profile national figures. We're going to take a call from Joe in northern New Mexico. Good morning, Joe.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired state worker, professional, and I just wanted to comment, you know, like the one of the earlier caller said, we do have dress code policies enforcing in the workplaces, you know, and then my take is, and again, this is coming from a 30-some year being there, and I'm saying if the dress codes are more enforced, and let's say, and I'm not totally defending the men, but it's a 50-50 thing where they have to be, if a woman wants to be respected, then she dress appropriately and not make any advances, or just respect her body, like a caller said earlier, the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, and that should be respected in that way. And the man will quickly get the message. But if there's an advance made by the male, and it's not quickly quenched, then it goes further. So it's on both sides of the blame that I can see. And of course, there's always the ones that are totally one-sided, and they're, you know, men are, you know, totally brutes or whatever. But I say if a woman respects herself and the lack of advancement in positions in trying to advance in the workplace, then it eliminates a lot of problems in the workplace.
All right, we're going to have to move on. What do you think about what Joe's saying here, Denicia?
Yeah, Marisa, I'm happy to see this cultural shift around Me Too, because it means I can have different conversations with my nieces about what their bodily dignity and self-determination means. And I only wish the teenage women that we work with at Young Women United that it was simple as what they wore or what they saw, because I know in my own life that, I've been bundled up and still been sexually harassed. I've worn less clothing in the summer. And if it was only as simple as what we wore or what we saw or where we walked, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And we wouldn't, like Pamela pointed out for us, have generations of systemic violence against women and girls in our communities. So I think this is really about teaching consent, about teaching bodily self-determination to our young ones, about how we really shift this conversation.
And we hear so many times from advocates that it really doesn't matter what you're wearing. Even if you are wearing a skimpier outfit, it still is not your fault that you are the recipient of harassment and assault, right?
Right. The real onus in this conversation is about the people perpetuating harassment and assault. This is about a power conversation. It has never mattered what young women, what girls, what LGBTQ people, what trans women of color have been wearing. It's about how systemic violence is perpetuated in our communities. And this onus should never be on recipients of that violence. It's around people who are perpetrating it.
And can you imagine, this is what I hear from Joe. He's saying, how dare you wear something that would arouse my sexuality or make me want to touch you? You must protect yourself from me, is what I hear him saying. So this is absolutely ridiculous. This is a statement that we've heard over and over again. Oh, women, you're wearing dresses that are just arousing me. So I say to people like Joe, it's time for you to put your hands in your pocket. It's time for you to think closely about what you're saying and about what you're thinking, because women have the opportunity and the absolute right to wear what they want to, and you don't have the right to be sexually aroused by it and to then take it out on them.
All right. Well, we're going to go now to a caller from Albuquerque. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your question or comment for us this morning?
My comment is almost like an apology to other women, because we end up in situations where we're complicit because we don't speak up, and because we're in situations in the private sector where, when I began encountering my abuse, if you will, in the workplace, 1997, and I ended up spending 21 years with a company, and the warning signs were at the beginning. In 1997, I was making a stand against discrimination to another past employer, and that had not been resolved yet, so I was in a compromised position career-wise, and got taken to a convention in 1997, showed up only to find that the owner of the business claimed to not have enough money to have beds for everyone. So we were stacked two to a bed, and I was chosen to sleep with the owner, share the bed with the owner of the business. That should have been a warning sign. But given that I had just gotten married and I brushed it off and stayed as clothed as possible when I slept, it was a history. It set the pace for a history of abuse and discrimination in the workplace. I feel complicit for not speaking up about it, because that endangers other women. Amen, by the way, to what the gentleman just said, in terms of men just simply changing their behavior and not blaming women for what they wear, because it doesn't matter. I wouldn't be considered the young and attractive get, if you will, but yet the harassment and the discrimination is there at all levels.
All right. Well, it is really not easy to talk about this kind of thing, so I want to thank you for calling in today. We're going to go to Devonna Bradford is the Sexual Assault Project Coordinator for the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Good morning, Devonna. Thanks for speaking with us.
Good morning, Marisa. Thank you for having me.
Devonna, the rate of assault is really high for Native women. What are some of the challenges for Native women who live on tribal lands when it comes to seeking justice or getting help after a sexual assault?
Some of the challenges that we're seeing and working with, I think one of the biggest challenges for us right now is jurisdiction. You know, when we're working with tribal communities, there are different layers to jurisdiction. You have tribal communities who fall under federal jurisdiction. They also have to, you know, of course, because they're on tribal lands, there's the tribal jurisdiction. You know, it's just the different layers of jurisdiction that create a challenge in law enforcement getting justice. You know, another challenge is law enforcement. You have some communities who are very small and don't have a law enforcement agency. And in these smaller communities, you have tribal leaders who are the first responders in that community when a sexual assault takes place. And oftentimes what we see happening is they will deal with this in their own way rather than calling law enforcement or calling, you know, the FBI to come in and investigate and take over. Another challenge would be just the fact that a lot of these communities are in rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
We've had, you know, some victims share with us that, you know, in some communities they can call law enforcement when there's a sexual assault or domestic violence incident. And because it's so rural, they can't get law enforcement out there fast enough. Instead, law enforcement might call them back a few hours later and ask if they're still needed to come. And, of course, they're still, you know, needed to come and and handle the situation. So those are just some of the challenges when it comes to violence, sexual violence, in tribal communities that we're seeing.
And also, I think Marianne spoke to this earlier too, but there's sometimes issues with language barriers as well. Is that right?
Yes, we have. You know, we don't have a lot of language access support in New Mexico for a lot of our different pueblos, a lot of different tribes in New Mexico. You would probably find a Navajo interpreter a lot easier than you could find a Pueblo interpreter, someone who speaks Karis or someone who speaks Zuni. And so there, you know, there was an incident a while back where one of our youth in one of our communities was using Karis to explain what, you know, what had happened to her. You know, and I understand that there are some families who speak English fine, but it's still important to have that language support available at all times, and we don't have that kind of support in New Mexico for all the different pueblos. We have 19 pueblos in New Mexico, two Apache tribes, and the Navajo Nation. So that's another challenge.
So this is something actually that Pamela was also talking about earlier in the hour, but she was saying that the United States as a country was founded on violence and on sexual violence, and this is also true of violence that was perpetrated against Native women. How do you think that history impacts what happens today?
This is a conversation that we make sure that we have every training that we put on, every educational presentation that we have with the community, because it has a lot to do with what we see in our communities today. Absolutely, it's part of the foundation for this country. You know, there is a quote by, you know, the government early on colonization, where knits make lice. So part of their military tactics to take over Native communities was to go after the women, to rape and kill women, to infect them with STDs, send them back into their communities. These mothers are breastfeeding. You know, so absolutely it's part of violence against Native women is part of the foundation for this country. And what we do, what's really important to us to remind our communities is, how did we get here? What is the connection between the history and what we see today? The high rates of violence, the shame, the guilt, the silence, and even the cycle of violence that we see, the cycle of abuse that we see in families. So reminding them how resilient our ancestors were before, you know, colonization, what kind of conversations were happening, how the matriarchs were educating youth about their bodies, and how there was, you know, the type of punishment there was for violence against women in those days were things like banishment. And so just kind of helping the community, reminding the community that, it wasn't always like this, you know, looking back and taking the resilience of ancestors and bringing it back to our communities, reminding communities that we have already what we need in our communities, culture, language, traditions, to be able to end violence against Native women. It's just, you know, helping. We're not teaching communities anything new. We're, you know, reminding them and helping them bring those tools back to today.
Do you think Me Too is going to have an impact on this longer conversation that we're having?
I hope so. I definitely feel like it will. You know, we see the same kind of things that we're seeing, you know, come to light. I feel like we're going to start seeing in our smaller tribal communities, Native communities. We definitely see, you know, the rape culture. You know, oftentimes our perpetrators are our own people, our own, you know, we have a shocking statistic in New Mexico, where close to 100% of perpetrators of, or close to 100% of Native victims reported that their perpetrators were also Native.
Devonna, like we're coming to the end of the show today. I appreciate so much you speaking with us. And we do have callers on the line that we didn't get to, and you can find all kinds of resources on our website. Thank you for joining us today on Let's Talk New Mexico. Corey Lee from Crossroads for Women, Denicia Cadena of Young Women United, Marianne Mendez-Serra from El Centro de Igualdad y Derechos, Pamela Herndon of the Southwest Women's Law Center, Devonna Bradford from the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native Women. Thanks, everyone. If you missed any of our program or if you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted to our website, KUNM.org, where you can also find the first part in our Me Too series. Turn in next week for the third show in this series with Sarah Gustavez. That show will focus on young people. Thanks to Marino Spencer, our engineer today. Victor Onimale screened your calls. Sarah Trujillo live tweeted the show. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Marisa DeMarco. This is KUNM.